Good afternoon, everyone. I feel I'm here at the wrong time because, you know, the exam is coming. The nerves, they're almost upon you, and you must be thinking about your exam. And perhaps this is not the time. This is not the time to you. This is not the time to engage in philosophy about learning. Nevertheless, this topic, which I'm not an expert on, this topic is very important. It will decide how much and how effective we can serve the community after our graduation. How much and how effective we can serve the community after the graduation. I say this because we study the teachings of the Buddha because we want to better ourselves firstly, and then we want to serve the community here and elsewhere. That's why we do this study. But then the approach we take, or the approach our teachers take, or rather the approach our institution, our university adopts, determines, you know, the course of our study. And not only the knowledge that we receive, but also the attitude that we form during our study, during our course of study. So you go through a certain course, some of them, sometimes you study text, sometimes you study subject thematically, you know, in terms of themes, not in terms of books. But whatever usually is what we call what people call here tradition, transmissive modus of knowledge. I have in my hand, this is about learning, teaching, assessment in higher education, that is at the university level. I follow the debate in higher education in the world, you know, what kind of approach people take. So the topic I'm trying to kind of provoke your thought today is student-centered learning. And you have learning, and here the title is learning, teaching, and assessment. You have learning, you have teaching. It's usually, when someone speaking in my place like this is called a teacher, I mean, he or she teaches you. And you are here to remember what is being taught and try to understand the information given to you. And in the exam, you are tested on the understanding of the information you receive from your teacher. This is called teacher-centered learning. Okay, as against student-centered learning. So this teacher-centered learning is also called traditional transmissive models of knowledge. So I better write something here. You have two approaches. One is teacher-centered learning. The whole process of learning is centered on the teacher. What he thinks, why he thinks, and how he thinks. Okay. It all relies on the teacher. Okay. What he thinks, okay, that this particular book should be studied. And how this book should be studied, and why he comes to this decision. Okay. So this is teacher's center. In this lecture hall today, I think we have about 40 people. It is a teacher's centered learning, but only the teacher's brain will be working fully. The other 40 brains will be very passive, not active, just learning, observing, that's all. You're not taking any initiative. You're not ensuring that this information that I'm giving, or the way this information is imparted, is correct. So you're not helping me. Instead, you're just here to passively observe me speaking and giving something. In other words, okay, 40 plus people, 40 people plus me, 41 brains. Only one is working. Before this class, only one person goes through the library. Okay, and so researches and reads relevant books, explore things related to this topic, only one person. If 41 million people, among 41 million people, only 1 million people work like that, 40 million people just passively walk behind. We think this is an underuse of energy, an underuse of your energy. So you should be encouraged to participate. You should encourage to use your brain, to ask questions. Better if you can read something before you come here. Before you come here about this topic. So, you know, I give this topic in advance so that you can do some research. At least if you read something, then you can see you are an active participant. If you have read something and come here. I usually make sure that when I give a Dhamma talk, okay, I give the title of my talk in advance. This is to trigger people to think about this subject. Trying to focus their mind on this subject. Instead of saying that, okay, Nibbana Yao Chao Deya Ho. Nibbana Yao Chao. You don't quite know what to expect If somebody say that, okay, someone is going to be talking about Nibbana Yao Jiao, okay, the way to Nirvana. We don't even know whether it's direct way or direct way or an indirect way, okay, to Nirvana. So just Nibbana Yao Jiao. That's very vague, very unfocused. So when people come to listen to you, you know, they are attracted to your personality, not focusing on the topic. I like very much the quotation attributed to the wife of President Roosevelt, Elizabeth Roosevelt, which runs like this. Small minds discuss people. Average minds discuss event. Great minds discuss ideas. Here I put and principles. I repeat again. Small minds discuss people. Small minds with S. Small minds discuss people. People, event, ideas. This is small mind. You focus on people. Average mind on events. You focus on event. Great minds discuss ideas and principle. So, if you go to a lecture because you are attracted to the speaker, because you admire the speaker, there's nothing wrong in that. You have every reason and every right to do that. But if you just follow the personality and you're not following the ideas, the thought, the philosophy, the teaching, is something like hero worship. Like, you know, young people, they worship a film star and so on. You see. But in Buddhism, we are trained to go much further and actually to rise above that. To rise above that, to actually focus on ideas. Then how to do that? How to do that? I don't have the answer. I'm just here to provoke you, okay, to ask questions, to challenge you, to think about this, to challenge, you know, what you know, to challenge your own knowledge, and also to look at everyone, okay, with knowledge critically. In the Vimamsaka Sutta in Majjhima Nikaya, that's the spirit that the Buddha gave us, to critically examine something. Of course, an easy reference is Ehipasiko. Okay. This is to critically look at the Dhamma. Because if we critically look at the Dhamma, our learning process is much quicker. The transformation is much quicker. So, teacher-centered learning and student-centered learning, I like to quote one thing. I'm going to read out slowly. I don't know, Sal, if you want to write on the whiteboard. First, I'm going to read it out to you. Relying too much on the teacher's understanding may leave the student without a fully functional personal understanding. Being able to pass exam by mimicking the lecturer's understanding, but not able to use it in other situations. So I'm going to ask Sally to write this quotation on the whiteboard. Just these three. You can erase this one. I think they have got this concept. Can come closer if you can't see clearly. You can come closer. I'm going to read out to you. My eyesight is not very good, so when I walk to you, okay, at the end of the table, I couldn't see any letters. So I'm going to read it, relying too much on the teacher's understanding may leave the student without a fully functional personal understanding, being able to pass exams by mimicking the lecturer's understanding. But not able to use it in other situations. This is from Ant Whistle, the old Ant Whistle, 2009, page 50. I had wonderful teachers when I was studying as a novice. I had wonderful teacher in Begu and also in Yangshui in Shanxi. But the only approach they knew was teacher-centered learning. My teacher, they knew only that. Okay? I doubt they ever heard of student-centered learning. But student-centered learning approach, we do have in Buddhism, in Tripitaka. We do have it. But my teachers, I don't think they knew it. So I learned what I was taught. Okay? I learned what I was taught. I think I spent about 10 years learning. About 10 years learning the Buddhist scripture until I passed the Dhammacharya degree. I passed the Dhammacharya degree in 1 year, and I was still a novice. On the second, that's 3 days ago, when I came back from Naypyidaw, transit in Yangon, and on my way to Hale, I was seated next to Yinan Changsiao, 85 years old, the head of Muidong Priyadis, I think, Muidong Paridekdo, 70-plus years, years old institute. Sarah told me that in 1952, he was the first ever in the history of Dhammacharya to have accomplished this degree course as a novice. And I met him. I was very pleased. What I'm trying to say is that we study very hard. But not very long after my graduation, I was invited to give a Dhamma talk, and I decided to talk about Kamma. I couldn't really finish it. I couldn't decide, I wasn't clear what was the main ideas, what was the main message, and that wasn't clear to me after 10 years of study. I knew how to read Pali and how to translate roughly. I knew it. Because in my Paramajita, I did it in Pali medium. Yeah, I sort of knew it. But the thing is that everything was teacher-centered. I didn't ask any question. So the understanding was my teacher's understanding, not my understanding. So when I had to present it, to talk about karma, in about 30 minutes, in about 20 minutes, actually, I didn't have anything to say. Like in Myanmar, you say, Vasanatha, that is grammatical definition, you give that out, and that doesn't mean anything, you know, for the listeners. They actually get nothing from that exercise. For me, it's a good exercise in terms of literally reading of the text. But I wasn't reading a text. I was giving a talk. I was trying to convince the people how moral responsibility is important, how we are responsible for our own decision, our own action, our own speech, and how we should be careful about this. You can even argue the whole social structure reflects the function of karma. But I didn't have any of this because I wasn't guided, okay? I wasn't given guidance to read different literatures by different people. In Myanmar, you know, it's a wonderful Buddhist land. You have many people, many teachers writing about karma. But we didn't have access to those books. Again, about Four Noble Truths, after my Dhammasara graduation, I struggled to explain that. Okay. What's about the Four Noble Truths? In Abhidhamma, everything, okay, we can analyze in Four Noble Truths. Tissa, Ivana, Yakabe. But that doesn't mean anything to the listener. Because we learn it, it's mimicking the lecturer's understanding. Okay. That's not our own understanding. So we couldn't say. And another thing is that in my hometown, I rarely visited my hometown. I was there about a year after my graduation. One gentleman, I think he was over 80, and he was 80 plus. He was on his dying bed, but he was fully conscious. His two sons invited me with a message that their teacher requested me to talk about the Satipatthana. I memorized Satipatthana at the age of 18. That's for the TOEIC exam. I also wrote it, I answered the question in the tone in Pali also. But when I had to talk to the gentleman, I had also gone through 10 days training of massive meditation, maybe about four times already. But when I was asked to talk to the gentleman in his last minutes, who was still fully conscious about the Satipatthana, I don't think I did it very well. You see? Because everything about the Satipatthana that we learned at that time was the teacher's understanding, not our understanding. It was the teacher's center, not our understanding. We were not asked to explore. We were not encouraged to explore. Actually, there are many writings on Satipatthana. By Mogol Sayadaw, by Mahasi Sayadaw, by Sia Uchi, by Mengkun Sayadaw, by many other teachers. And if you can read in English, a lot more. In today's world, can I have those books? In today's book, Mindfulness, Meditation, and Neurology, you see, neurology. Now, I learned it by myself by reading this book. This is by one clinical psychologist and from Oxford, and also a journalist. Mindfulness, an 8-week plan for finding peace and in frantic world. This is psychiatry. Mindfulness and psychiatry. The mind and the brain. A student of our first lecture, Sarah, Dr. Silananda Bionsa, from UCLA School of Medicine. See? From Harvard University Business Review, Mindfulness, Emotional Intelligence. Something similar to that, without using mindfulness, this is a professor from Oxford, Susan Greenfield, an expert, a world-renowned expert on neurology. Finally, two professors have declared meditation as a science, the science of meditation. You see, we didn't have access to these resources, and we were not encouraged to see them. Look at the Buddha. When he was learning, before his enlightenment, it was mainly student-centered. He himself was a student. He chose the course. He decided to go to Alarakalama first, and then Uddakarama Buddha. He designed the course he did like. He went to see them, he approached them, and he asked them, what you have to offer me? I have this question, this burning question for human beings. So what do you have to offer me? They said, we have this. Then he studied genuinely, okay, diligently. He completed the course. He knew straight away that this was not what he was looking for, because there was student-centered learning, very active participant, Princeton, very active participant. Again, he moved to another teacher. This is another school, if you like, it's another university. Okay, I've come from that school. I have learned all what they had to teach me. I have this question. What have you got to offer me? And they said, you know, we have this. You can try it out. And he did it. He did it. Very genuinely, very respectfully. Hoping that he would get the answer. Something would come out of that course. Okay. He was very respectful to the teacher. And at the end of the course, when the teacher was very successful, now he wasn't mimicking the teacher's understanding, because he made the teacher's understanding his own. And he was able to say, actually, your understanding is good, but not good enough for me. So, goodbye. See? And he went on to do another practice, that is, in today's term, he went to another meditation teacher, or he went to another university. Jaina practice, the practice of asceticism. And he did it. You can say that he graduated with first class, with double A, you can say. But then he was able to review the knowledge he has got. And he said, actually, the knowledge I have got from you and the knowledge that you have is not good enough for the task, for the challenges that we face as a human being. You can see the student-centered learning in the Buddha's life, in the way he was looking for knowledge. He was very active. So you have to be an active learner, and that is that his students are learning. I'm going to, I think, I don't have much to say. I'm going to conclude with another piece of argument, and then we open up the discussion. This is called affective learning process. Learning process which is affective. It involves three elements. This is, if you like, the latest theory in learning, in higher education learning, in university learning. The first one is called associationist approach. Associationist approach. How difficult is it to pronounce? The second one is cognitive perspective. Cognitive perspective. The third one is situative. It's very technical. Situation. Okay. Situative perspective. Associationist approach means you learn by associating. By associating with people, by associating with concepts, by associating with, if you are a scientist, you know, instruments and tools, by associating with them more and more. By familiarizing yourself with the thing you are learning about. If it's chanting, then by hearing again and again, by participating in chanting, different style of chanting. This is by association, learning by association. In Mangala Sutta, in Pali, we call sevana. Sevana. So, you should associate only with wise people, not otherwise, not the opposite. This is, and also in terms of books, you should choose what is good for you. Positive one, that sort of thing. So, the first one is associationist approach. Very difficult to pronounce. The second one, cognitive approach. Cognitive is like mindfulness, memory. Okay. You train yourself in mindfulness, in memory. In memory and in concept transformation. In mindfulness means in attention. You learn how to pay attention. Some student who cannot pay 100% attention to the discussion, they don't actually benefit much from the lecture, from associating with people, with the teacher, with other students, with other learners. They don't actually benefit a lot from the first one. So the second one is about your attention ability that Buddhism talks about as sati, or mindfulness. And memory, how much you can remember. This memory, maybe we can discuss if anyone has any question. So memory, and another one is transformation process. The knowledge that we learn, that we come to know, whether it's transforming us. As you know, the Buddha's teaching, the sole purpose of the Buddha teaching is this one, the same. This is false boat, this expert. It's the same. This is the whole purpose of the Buddha's teaching. Dhamma chakka, pavatanasa chakka. Chakka means wheel. The wheel means transport. It's a symbol. It's a symbol of knowledge. So any knowledge has to be transformative. It transports you from A place to B place, to place A to place B. Place A is, okay, when you're upset, you want to be in a situation where you are no longer upset. When you have fear, you need something to transport you from fear into fearlessness. When you have tension, you need something to transport you from tension to freedom from tension, to the situation where you are relaxed. You need something to transport. That transport is called chakra, or chakra in Sanskrit. We call it sancha in Burmese. The meaning is that the whole purpose of learning in Buddhism is transformative. It's transformation. Transformation from ignorance to wisdom, from anger and hatred to compassion, from fear to courage. So it's about transformation. The cognitive perspective. Cognitive is psychological term. It's psychological term. And the last one is situative perspective. Situative is the word situation. That is the social context. You learn from the social context. You also modify your understanding based on what you have learned from social context. I have learned from social context, for example, I come back to the Vinaya, the Buddha's teaching, that literally speaking, it's okay for monks and lay people to sit at the same table and eat. But you don't touch food, each other's food, you don't share food. You just eat in your own plate. Okay, if you only eat in your own plate, there's nothing wrong with the Vinaya. I revisit this concept in the Vinaya. I found out that eating in a round table like this is perhaps sharing so much food, okay? Also, the dishes, as we do, is more unique to Southeast Asian countries. That's the way what we call eating habit. Lay people eat like that. Monks eat like that. But in the Vinaya, nothing is mentioned about round table eating. Nothing is mentioned about that. Monks eat, okay, in that bowl, alms bowl. It doesn't say anything about how and where you sit. But culturally, here in this country, socially, if you are considered higher, okay, you are given a separate table. And the people considered to have more or less equal status, they gather around the same table, like that. So it's a kind of social status influenced by local culture. Local culture. In Singapore, a Seattle was invited to eat at a restaurant because many Singaporeans, they don't cook at home. They just eat outside. At the restaurant, people, they would buy food, offer food to him, but they like to sit at the same table. The Seattle wouldn't have it. He insisted that he was given a separate table. The Chinese people, they were very upset. They were made to sit at a different table. They told me that, okay, we look like we were having a quarrel, that we couldn't sit at the same table. Again, this is Singaporean culture, which is influenced so much by Western culture. In Myanmar, we wouldn't look at that situation in that way. Seattle's insistence is correct in Burmese culture, in Thai culture. In Burmese as well as in Thai culture. Then, what about the role of culture? Do we have to accommodate culture? I think, whenever possible, if it doesn't go against the spirit of non-violence, the spirit of simplicity, like that, you know, the Buddha accommodated those local customs, like not cutting trees, monks not being allowed to cut trees like this. That's to accommodate the culture, the opinion from Jainism, the dominant religion in Rajagaha, because the Buddha was making an attempt to live there. Buddhists were minority. The Buddha actually was new to the town. Only after 3 years of stay over there, okay, Buddhism got a firm hold in Rajagaha. At the beginning, the Buddha had to accommodate their culture. So, when we travel like this, when we learn about this thing, now we come to see different culture. In Myanmar culture, in Burmese culture, in eating, people share soup, one soup. Everyone dips in. But they have separate rice, okay, rice plate. I visited a Plum monastery, a Plum village. They had exactly opposite culture. They share rice, okay, a big bowl of rice in the middle, a different bowl of soup. Exactly different. So, I stopped judging who is right and who is wrong. It's just culture. So, you have to engage with the culture to see where you should draw the line, how much you should accommodate. In that case, you have to be an active participant. So that kind of situation is called situated perspective. Situated perspective. So in learning, effective learning means learning which is in my teacher's philosophy, Mian Gong Dada. It takes less time It takes little time. Mian, gao. Okay. Gao is, the result is very good. Theta, the student and the teacher. Theta, how do you say, how do you translate samadhi? Theta, that is, you don't drain out your thought too much. You just use minimal physical energy and you get maximum benefit. Theta, that means, okay, not very strenuous. In that, that's called effective learning. That process involves these three elements, according to Professor Sally Brown from England. So one is by associating with people. So here at ITBMU, for example, we have the Department of Patipatti. If we associate with teachers, meditation teachers, we learn from them, from different meditation teachers. This is through association. In Sri Lanka, at the end of each one, each good deeds, people always say, Imina punya kamena mami bala samakamo. Because of these good deeds, may I not associate with bad people. Because I wouldn't be learning good things from them. I wouldn't be learning useful things from them. Okay, so association is very important. In okay, association. And here, I would like to make one remark. Liberalism. Liberalism is very important. The Buddha was very liberal when he was a student looking for enlightenment. You can roughly say, widely recognized meditation teachers, there were three groups. The two teachers, Anakarama and Udakarama Buddha, two separate groups, and then Jainism. You can say that those three are three organized meditation groups. Not just individual meditation teacher, but the teacher with large followings. And Prince Siddhartha, he was very liberal. He had an open mind. He tested everyone out. Okay. He wanted to see what they had to offer. If their knowledge was good enough to help people at large who are suffering. So liberal means, okay, without being judgmental, he approached them and he studied from them. He was open to all of them. We have more than 10 meditation techniques in Myanmar. If we follow a liberal approach, we are going to benefit so much from this. But if we restrict ourselves to one particular tradition, each and everyone tradition is very good. It has been tested, verified through experiences, okay, for many generations. But you have to test whether you can make that particular teacher's understanding yours. Because it has to be your experience at the end. And which technique suits you? No teachers can tell you. Only the Buddha can tell you. We are not fortunate anymore to have that advice from the Buddha, so we have to test it out. So a liberal approach is very important. For example, if we study paramattha. What does it mean by paramattha? Then find out who have written on this topic, and what's their understanding. First, okay, you're trying to see the current literature as it is. And then, in the process of absorbing and trying to create your own understanding, you ask questions. That's a process of transforming, but transforming other people's knowledge into your own. We call this the stage Sudhamaya Jnana, Jindamaya Jnana. Jindamaya Jnana is the very important one. If you just listen to the teacher, you don't actually have this perspective, Jindamaya Jnana. Transformative knowledge means this bhavanamaya jnana. When the knowledge that you have acquired, not all of it, okay, will be transformative for you, because you can't connect with all of them. But sometimes certain approach just doesn't fit you. But there will be some that clicks. Our task is to go through the process to find that out. When that happens, transformation takes place within us. People say transformation takes place also in the brain. In the brain. Some people say as quick as 3 weeks. As 3 weeks. This psychiatrist, professor of research, psychiatry, he says that some of the method used in behavior psychology, they are very harmful, they don't work, and you can safely replace them with mindfulness. And he has tested that. And so this is his report. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, he's the student of our first founder, Sero, Dr. Silananda. And this book was published to mark the 75th birthday of our first rector. So transformative. Put it in another way, we say in Buddhism the stages of learning. Pariyati, patipati, and patipati. Pariyati, that's pure learning. That's just trying to digest and understand information. Patipati, you process that. You apply that. You make it yours. You make that knowledge yours. That knowledge becomes transformative. So that's patipatti. And then we get the benefit of the knowledge that we have. That's a totally transformed and positive, compassionate person on earth. I think Buddhism has both the student and teacher-centered learning, our task is to find the middle way. So I open the floor to you. If you have any question or any comments, welcome. If you want to speak, please. Yes, can you speak to the microphone? Thank you. Can you first introduce yourself? Thank you.
Sera, I am Sally Kemawangsi from Indonesia. So what Sera think about the system in ITDMU? This is the teacher-centered learning or the student-centered learning? Thank you.
I usually don't make comment on Facebook. I think I better not start today. I think it depends on individual teachers. I can't comment on the institution, okay? I have not thought through of this. But some teacher will be following teacher's center. But some people, some teachers, you know, may be opening up. Rekha say, what does it mean by university? That's to be, okay, as wide as universe in terms of knowledge, to actually open ourselves to the universe of knowledge. Rekha Sara himself, okay, he reads a lot. He reads from every tradition. And then he makes the information, you know, his own. You see? His own knowledge. So I think it depends on individual teachers, and I think you are in a better position to judge.
So, Sarah, which criteria should we follow to be student-centered learning? Which criteria should we follow?
Suppose we are studying the topic of Four Noble Truths, the most important topic. There are many ways to study this. You can study this through Abhidhamma, you can study this through Patisasamubbada, you can study this through Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, you can study this even through neurology like this, or through psychology like this. But how much the students how much they are exposed to the available resources sometimes depends on how liberal is the teacher. Sometimes the teacher limits the student. The teacher constrains them. Okay, confine them only to a certain resource. Not opening up. Okay, other accesses, access to other resources. So, to demonstrate our student-centered learning, okay, we have many students here, we also have many teachers here. Shall we identify the sources of the Four Noble Truths in Burmese and in English, also in Pali? I'm going to write down. I'm going to be your secretary. Okay. I write it. I volunteer to be your secretary. First, I'm going to say that, okay, what the Buddha taught, there's this Wabra Rahula. That's what the Buddha taught. What the Buddha taught. Can you add the second one? Can anyone add? The ancient path of the Buddha. The Buddha's ancient path. There's a Piyadasi there. Oh. Pain and its ending. I can't remember the author's name. Eh? Okay. It's about pain and its ending. Pain is ending. You have Mahasi Sero's Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. What else? Dr. Devadatta's Dr. Vivadatta, the first sermon of the Buddha, same. A lot from Mogok Sero, can anyone quote? In Mogok, something that some of his disciples presented, like Sen Ukanya, these are Levi, these are the movement, for example. And what else? This is the task of the teacher to prepare this. To survey the whole literature. To survey the whole literature. And then list them in terms of years of publication. Because you need to see the history of the development of ideas, how ideas develop. So, if you have got you also have, you know, all the books on, like, Introduction to Buddhism, written by anyone, that would include the Four Noble Truths. Peter Harvey, for example, from England, and Rupert Cathin, also from England, published by Oxford University Press, some people from America, quite a lot of them. Every 2.5 years, there is one book published in the West on introduction to Buddhism since 1884. I looked at books available at Oxford University Library, and I calculated the time. So since 1884, every 2.5 years, the longest, there will be one book in the market introducing Buddhism to people. And people keep updating about it. Then it's the task of the teacher to make use of this. Okay. The teachers have to have to summarize the ideas in this and formulate those ideas in terms of question. Two questions, three questions, for example. If I come up with two or three questions, then I ask students to answer this question by writing an essay. And they have to read this. Student, I know straight away when I read that essay whether they have read every book I recommend them. If they have, I also know whether they have understood properly, whether there's any idea they have advanced a little bit. By doing this, you make students to go through literature by themselves. Students are not here to copy what the teacher is saying. In some of our government universities I have visited 16 universities, medicine, engineering, arts and science, I have visited 16. In some of them, the textbooks are available only to the teachers. The teacher reads them and then share the information with the student. Thus, the student wouldn't have access to these resources. Then the teacher and the university, they have to work together that these resources are available in the library. They also have to make sure that the learning process and the library, okay, they are integrated, fully integrated. When I do this, I will give you, for example, I give you the library number, the catalog number here. You can go and find those books easily in the library. I will also give you the page numbers I want you to read, page 30 to 45, 30 to 65. You know what you have to do straight away. See, students should know what they are expected. In some of the exams in some country, I don't know, in Myanmar, I've been away for 30 years. The teacher would like to surprise the student. Student can't, they don't actually know what would appear in the exam. What they are asked to try to understand. For my BA student, I would try to tell them, okay, you should understand the Four Noble Truths. As a text, you should understand the original text, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Secondary sources, you have this, 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 you have this. For example. So this is about the Four Noble Truths. About the dependent origination, you should read this book and you should understand it. And there are two approaches, three approaches. And these are how they are. And when I ask a question, I'm going to test, okay, how far you can push your knowledge. Is it just to memorize this, to remember this, what these teachers say? Or whether you are actually commenting on them with your own logical understanding. If you comment with your own logic understanding, you know, you are qualifying first class. But if you give everything from the book back, maybe you get second class. So I would tell them this way at the beginning of the year. If you perform like this, you get first class. If you perform like this, second class. If you perform like this, it's a simple pass. Students should be clearly told what is expected of them, what they are required to do. You see? In addition to this, students should be encouraged to sit together and discuss. Discuss about this topic, the Four Noble Truths, like this. That would be cognitive approach. Cognitive approach is that, okay, you pay attention to the other person's, what he's saying in the group. If you have a group of three students, you pay attention to what the other person is saying. If I'm teaching in Burmese, I would add a lot of Dhamma talks here on the Four Noble Truths. I would add a lot of Dhamma talks. So if I say, okay, this year we studied these 10 topics, I will never ask outside these topics. I will never surprise you. That's not fair to you. That's not fair to you. What I want to know is that how you process information, how you transform that, whether you can generate your own understanding. I don't really want to know how much you can remember. Because part of memory is good. Memory is important. Because in the brain, the area called hippocampus is responsible for memory, for decision making, for calming the mind. You see, they are neurologically, they have a reason to be together. So memory is very important. And these people say, I'd like to read out one. Emotional Intelligence, Mindfulness is from Harvard University Review. This is a review of many other books, many other researchers' books. It's not the original writing, but it's the writing to summarize many original research findings. The topic is mindfulness can literally change your brain. I read from page 31, quote, the second brain region we want to highlight is the hippocampus, a region that show increased amounts of gray matter in the brains of our 2011 mindfulness program participants. This seahorse-shaped area is buried inside the temple on each side of the brain and is part of the limbic system, a set of inner structures associated with emotion and memory. Hippocampus. Okay. emotional memory, is covered in receptors for the stress hormone cortisol. And studies have shown that it can be damaged by chronic stress, contributing to a harmful spiral in the body. Indeed, people with stress-related disorders like depression and PTSD tend to have a smaller hippocampus. So, when we open up, okay, if you limit a certain, if you need resources, because the student, they are in their first, second year of a BA study, then this is fair enough to introduce them a certain literature, the original one, the secondary one, the primary, secondary. And then, as they advance in their study, you ask if they can find a topic on their own to write an essay. And if they can kind of explore the literature by themselves. In this way, you free them from your control. You set them free. This is usually done at the master's level in the West. But these days, people transfer this expertise to kind of final years in the bachelor degree. Any more questions and comments? Can you come to the microphone here? Please have a seat.
Sir, my name is Utpanna. I'm from Nepal. And I have a couple of questions. Should I ask all of them at once or one by one?
It's your choice.
Okay. Like in... okay, first this one. Like in case of spiritual practice, what I've been... what I've understood is that teacher is very much necessary, and actually when meditating, our mind can deceive us, and it's the teacher who can... like see from outside and guide us, so you have to like totally depend on teacher, and even if your logic or your brain says, your idea says it's right, but if your teacher says that it's wrong, then you have to follow a teacher, like during the in case of the meditation practice. So please comment on that.
I agree with you that it's important to have the teacher, and it's important to follow the instruction faithfully. But this doesn't mean that you surrender yourself, you know, to the teacher. The Buddha, when he was searching for enlightenment, he followed very faithfully the teaching of Alara. And Uddaka, he followed them very faithfully. But he didn't surrender himself to them. He retained freedom of thought, freedom of decision. At the end of the course, when he thought this was not for him, he said goodbye to them. So, you rely on a teacher so that one day you can fully rely on yourself. Obaneiko means, you know, relying on yourself. Applying the teaching on yourself. Making the teaching, to make the teaching go with you wherever you go, Obaneiko. To make the teaching part of yourself. That's part of learning. the criticism. Yes, with respect to the experience of teacher and here, we are determined to test it out, what he says, in this particular course. I think that's correct. But you follow the teacher, but you don't surrender to the teacher. In Christianity, when you are ordained, one of the rules is that you surrender to your leader, to the bishop who ordains you. You surrender to God, so you just obey. In the Vinaya, sometimes the student has to help the teacher. You can say, Bidu Chittam, Buddha Chittam, between Upachaya and teacher. If Upachaya is deviating from the path, then the student has most responsibility to help the teacher to return to the correct path. This is to say that or to put it in another way, we talk about attadibhati, lokadibhati, dhammadibhati. Adibhati here means priority or paying respect or make it a crucial factor in walking the path. Attadibhati means you judge by yourself. But this is not enough. Lokadibhati, you also use other people's opinion, other people's experience, the society's experience, and the teacher is part of this. Finally, what is most important, dhammadibhati. That's the dhamma has to be the final. So the Buddha, with appointing any successor, he left the teaching to guide us, dhammadibhati. So we understand our role, we understand the teacher's role, we also understand what the Dhamma is going to reveal to us in the course of the practice.
Thank you, Sayadaw. Another question is, these concepts and ideas do you think they will work in case of a traditional system where there are many students, like 200 or 500 students and one teacher? Usually what we see in the monastery settings. Like in university settings, I believe like these are the perfect, I mean, it's how the universities and like modern education systems would go on. But we also have that traditional side, right? So how do you think we can, I mean, they can be applicable in that setting also?
I think we have to trust the individuals, the student, maybe 500 students. Soon after his enlightenment, on his way to Rajaka, when the Buddha visited the Kasapa brothers and his and their followers, there's how many of them? 1,000, maybe more. Just one teacher. I like very much the innovative approach that some of the teachers did. Not all of them. In England, children as young as maybe 6 years old, 7 years old, one teacher to 20 students. This is how the teacher teaches them to be observant. To be observant. And she would tell them, okay, three of you, one group, three of another group. So she would form them into many groups. And they would be standing near the traffic. I didn't understand at first. But later, I came to know the teaching. The teacher would be standing there just to make sure that the kids are safe. Then the kids were given a task to perform, just to count the number of cars passing by, so that they observe them. This is cognitive process. When they are 6 years or 7 years old, this. And they have to discuss among themselves how many. And when they go back to the class, they will report to the class how many they got. Everything is given applause. No one is wrong. Why? Because the right and wrong is not important here. What is important? That the kids learn how to observe, how to pay attention. Number one. Number two, three students learn how to work together from a young age. If you equip them with this kind of skill, you can have 1,000 students. During the World War II, the whole country, only one person was speaking, Prime Minister Churchill. The whole country was downbeat. Okay, they were, you know, kind of feeling very low. But when he spoke, he inspired them, so that the future Queen, Princess Elizabeth, took up a task of driving an ambulance. Everyone participated. People never complained. Okay, they queue for food. You know, we can still see in the museum, in the library, in some people's home, you know, the is it the ticket, you know, the ticket for ration food. They never complained at that time, and everyone participated in the effort to defend the country. They see that as a bigger purpose to bring peace back to the world. Only one person was teaching the whole country, that's Prime Minister Churchill. He told them, a pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty. This difficulty gives us opportunity to transform ourselves, to help ourselves, and to help other people. And they did. England is a very small country. But they rose, I mean, they punched above their weight, if you like. See? So, from time to time, you have that kind of people. And in my role, I saw him at that particular moment, not as Prime Minister, but rather as a teacher. Okay, who was also leading, who was able to motivate people. So the teacher's duty is to inspire other people to learn, to transform themselves, to believe in the good things. So I take your point. If you have a smaller group of people in the class, the learning is much quicker. I know this. Because in Oxford, you have one teacher to 3 to 4 students like that. So it's very effective. No brain is passive. In the class, every brain is active. You see? 13,000 students, 13,000 brain, every brain is active. Some master students, they create this kind of thing. They create many things just at master level in engineering. Some master students, they wrote dictionary, that sort of thing. They did wonderful thing because no brain was passive. Every brain was active. The word bhavana that I know in the Buddhist teaching, the word sikha, they are very active. Sikha is active, bhavana is active. It's not passive at all. You see? So if you can make people's brain active, if you can make their brain work and function, then one teacher maybe, well, people say a good teacher is a teacher who who makes himself unemployed. He teaches people how to learn, how to rely on themselves. At some point, they no longer need him, so he becomes unemployed. This is the best teacher.
Others don't have questions, sir.
One more question.
Actually, I have two questions.
One first.
Okay.
just to be fair to others, one.
Okay. It was interesting when you mentioned that when you, like, according to different culture and, like, the Vinay rule, about, like, eating in the, sharing the table, and in that kind of context, my question is, from your experience, like, since you have been to different places, and what's the balance point, like, where you follow your Vinaya plus at the same time you also respect the culture and the people around, like, what factors you think should we keep in mind, like, when to strictly follow Vinaya and when to, like, you know what I mean, like the balance point.
In the, you know, when you say the Vinaya, you mean is very general. Actually, the Vinaya rules themselves, some of them they follow culture, some of them they ignore culture. Some of them ignore culture. Okay. We call this loka vacha pannati vacha. Loka vacha is because the society thinks it's an offense, it's bad. So the Buddha follows them and creates a rule. Pannati vacha means the Buddha doesn't take the account of social value into consideration. He thinks this is bad and he laid down a rule. So in the Vinaya itself, you know, we have two categories of rules. It's not about Vinaya versus culture. It's not as simple as this. But culture, they have a boundary. A certain Burmese culture valid only up to Ming Lado Airport. When you fly out of the country, that culture is not valid. But some culture, they are valid universally. Some of the Burmese culture. You see. So we have to see. For example, when people offer food to the monks in Myanmar, people stay around the table. It's impolite to leave the monks to themselves. People should be there, looking after them, tending them. Especially when the monks are invited home. This is Myanmar culture. It has its value. It's valid here. You see, I think it's beautiful. But when you fly out of Ming Lado, you land in Bangkok, when people offer you food like this, as soon as they offer you, they leave the room. They leave you alone. They say it's impolite to be around, to make the monks uncomfortable. They wouldn't be able to eat. You put them under pressure. So it's impolite to stick around. You better leave the monks alone. They have their own reason, and the whole country accepts it. In Myanmar, the Myanmar reason, the whole country accepts it. So each culture is valid in within its own border. You see? So, culture valid. But in terms of, if you're going to look at the Vinaya, we don't really care if you stay around, if you go away. We don't mind. You see? So this is the kind of thing. Then again, in Sri Lanka, if you place food on the table, monks actually don't take it from there. They only eat what is put in their plate, in their alms bowl. When Sri Lankan people see monks actually taking by themselves food from, place in the table, they were horrified. Look. You see? That's in Sri Lanka. And we have to know that. When we go to Sri Lanka, we have to respect their culture, their sentiment, because we have no time to change their culture. The culture as it is can be used positively as a vehicle to transport a message, an important message of the Buddha to them. So, I think I have given, unfortunately, it's in Burmese at the University of Culture, a lecture called Value and Culture. When Thai people leave after they offer food to the monk, they do so out of respect. When Myanmar people stay around after they offer, also this is out of respect. So the value is the same, but the culture is different. Any other questions? Okay, Sally.
Siaro mentioned that in Buddhism has both teacher-centered learning and student-centered learning. Mm. So can we give the example like the Kalyana Metta, that teacher is very important? Yeah, so in that case, is this example imply, can we imply this example that teacher-centered learning? And another one is that Atta-Dipa, we have Raja. Then this is student-centered learning, to my understanding. Mm-hmm. Is it correct, Seyano?
Yes, I think so. In terms of importance of the teacher's role, I have never counted this, but again and again is written in by many authors in Buddhist, in Burmese Buddhist writing, also quoted by some preachers, that the Buddha mentioned 528 times Yatha Buddhang Dasanaya Satha Priyasitapo, in order to know things as they are, the truth, we should look for a teacher. And you can see the structure between the preceptor and student. If there's no preceptor to teach this particular student, to look after this particular student, no one is admitted into the order. That is, a student has to have someone committed to looking after his or her welfare and well-being, spiritually and otherwise. Otherwise, they are not admitted into the order. You can also see, many practices along the way, like Vanaka teaching, that sort of thing. The development of the Sangha, the development of the methods of propagation in Buddhism throughout the years. I think there's no doubt the role of the teacher is very crucial. Nevertheless, the teacher is not here to look after you all the time. In Bhikkhuhood, the Buddha said, the teacher has the responsibility to look after the student for 5 years. after 5 years, the student should become independent. The teaching should be designed in such a way that after 5 years, the student can think for himself independently, can look after himself. We call this Acharya Mudra, you see, independent of teachers. Because the teacher has to take in new students, and the old one need to graduate. So after 5 years, you go like this. You can see the relation between the teachers and student, and how the aim of the teacher is to establish his students as individuals so that they become well-versed, well-established, well-practiced in the Dhamma. As individual, okay, we are responsible for our own action, our own karma. You see? We cannot blame our you can blame Ajatasattu, okay. You can blame Devadatta, you can see the role of the teaching. But I think it's misreading of the individual's responsibility to say that it's down to Devadatta entirely that Ajatasattu kill his teacher, kill his father. I think we ignore his personal responsibility. In the eyes of law, you wouldn't punish his teachers alone. You would also punish him. You would put both of them into prison. Sally, you have something.
Thank you so much, Siado, for your very inspiring lecture. For us, we always feel that we got motivated and inspired after hearing your talk or lectures. So practically, how do we motivate students so that they have the feeling to explore, that is to read further, like to join the lectures and to read more, doing research and feel like doing research, because this is what we experience here. So while Siaro is giving lecture, I was observing that everyone was paying attention to what Siaro was telling, so I'm sure they're interested. But they feel hesitant to ask because they normally don't have the habit, or they feel shy to speak in the public. So how do we motivate and inspire them? And another question, in a classroom with a big size, how do we motivate and inspire, especially motivate and encourage students who come from different level and different background? Thank you very much.
For the first question, I don't have the answer. I don't know the answer. how to motivate students. If I have, okay. I wouldn't hesitate to share it with you. But one thing that has informed me recently from my own reading, from my own study, is that positive reinforcement is the best thing. Positive reinforcement is you're trying to find something positive in the student, collectively and individually, and you make sure that they know that you know. Okay, you make sure that they know that you know about that, about those positive things. Students are very anxious about exam because they are very worried that you don't know what they know. Okay. They are very worried that you don't know enough, that they know enough. I'm just playing with words. So what I'm trying to say is that to try to find out pieces of work, activities, behavior that are positive, and try to discuss them. Usually people are very stressed out, very concerned, very overstressed about completing the syllabus. That anxiety is not helpful because you damage your memory when you are overstressed. You damage your memory. You cannot retain a lot. So you have to relax, you have to feel positive, you have to rejoice, you have to see everyone's or most people's positive contribution. When you are relaxed like that, different part of your brain works. The part of the brain that is good for memory works. It's very easy for you to remember. But when you are very stressed out, like before the exam like this, the more you worry, the harder you have to remember what you have studied. So what I usually tell students is that if you have 10 pages to read, okay, you already know page number 1. Then when you start working, don't start from page 2. Start from page 1, the one you already know. Maybe you should read page 1 twice. Read this. You come to the end, I know it already. Read it again. At the end of page 1, you become reassured that I know it already. We call this positive reinforcement. Anup Modana. Modana means rejoice. Anup means again and again. It's called positive psychology. With this, the student become enthusiastic. Okay. They are calm to process. They are going to make use of what they already know as a foundation. With that, self-confidence, the other 9 pages, they will learn quickly. But if they are very worried about what they don't know, so they skip what they already know, page number 1. They start reading page number 2. With anxiety, they are going to retain very little from what they read. This is the latest psychology, neurology, and mindfulness, research. We talk about creative thinking. The mind is not creative when it has chronic stress. So stress management is very important. And in terms of the teacher, if you reassure them, you have already completed the classwork. For second year student, you tell them you have already done your first year, so you have nothing to worry for second year, you have already got the experience. If you talk about what they have already done and they have already achieved, you start with, you give them 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, only that much. Give them this much. This is called positive reinforcement. Subhasita cha yavanta. In the blessing. So, it's positive speech. That's part of learning. Bahusachanja, Sipanja, Vinayasa, Susikito, Subhasyaja. The whole standard is about learning, is about education. You see? Positive reinforcement. And after that, they would go away and they would try to learn more from the rest. I think being positive, positive reinforcement, a positive thinking teacher can inspire students. every time you just nag and nag and nag at them, you know, you haven't done this, I ask you to do it many times. If you do that, you yourself, you produce a lot of stress receptor hormone. If the mother tells her child once and the child follows it, the mother produces the stress hormone just once. So she has to clear this without much effort. But if she has to tell the child five times, she produces stress hormone five times more. It takes longer time for her to clear those stuff from her system. It takes longer for her to recover. You see? In that aspect, being positive is good for everyone. Being positive. So, some teacher, they would like to motivate their student with fear. You see, if you don't learn this, you're going to fail your exam. If you don't learn this, you're going to have to repeat this another year. Fear, 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 fear everywhere. You see? You motivate them with fear. Positive reinforcement instead of negative reinforcement. The Buddha gives a very positive message, dukkha nirodha, that whatever problem you face, you can bring that to an end. And there's a way to do that. Dukkha nirodha gamini vidibhidhariya. So in the first lecture itself, the Buddha gave out a very positive message. You don't have to wait until next life, and you don't have to rely on other people. You can actually do it yourself. It's a very positive message that the Buddha gave from the very beginning. I think without the help of psychology and neurology, I wouldn't see this point. I think. Actually, the Buddha is very positive. Positive psychology is very new in the West. It's less than 20 years old. For every positive for every one paper and book published about positive psychology, there are 21 books and articles on negative psychology. So the whole world is negative. We call this negativity bias. The positive people are the minority. The Buddha said it's like swimming against the stream. But don't worry, you can swim it. This is the positive message. Anyone? Oh, no, you have a second question. What's the second question?
I was telling that no answer to the first question, and I think that's the answer to the second question.
What's the second question?
I have forgotten, Seattle.
Huh?
You have forgotten.
Thank you very
much. Actually, I was asking... My second question was how do we handle
the classroom
size and motivate them since they come from different levels?
I think your question has already contained the answer and is part of it. You see, students have different capacities. Your task as a teacher is to find out who can be the leader. In every classroom throughout the world, people find a capable person to become monitor, that sort of thing. People who can help students. In Pakoku, you call that sasu, for example. So, if you have, if you can find out more capable students and give some simple tasks to them to prepare some work, with this to train them so that they can help you. When I did my Dhammaja, I helped my teacher with translation in the class. I saw other people did that and I went and asked if I could do that. It was hard. So after lunch, I didn't rest. So With that, you take the responsibility very gladly. You know it's a very serious task, very hard one. But you are proud to do that. You're proud to do that. After you have done one or two days, you know, you build up confidence. So one of our teachers would rotate students to do that in order to give confidence to each and everyone. I think that's a good thing, but in my case, if I have to do the same thing, I would give one student about 1 week so that they have enough time to build confidence. If you delegate that to them, people call this in modern management, they call it a chain of command. Chain from the highest and down, and from top to bottom, to bottom, from bottom up. A chain of command. Different levels of responsibility. So in the class, you can find this out. Chain of command. In terms of administration, in terms of executing a plan, we have to have different responsibilities. And this is called chain of command. We have rector, above rector, we have university council, we have Nanda Banka Manaka, for example, then the rector, deputy rector, and then heads of, I mean, the deans and heads of department, and so on. These are the chain of command. We don't use it here because it's not the type of word that we are comfortable with, but we have the same structure. So, in the same class, if you can find that out and differentiate people according to their ability. I don't use the word discriminate, but it's actually discrimination. And it's valid. In Oxford, everywhere, they write just to inform students, except in academic ability, it's against the law to discriminate. So in the class, it's okay to say, this person is more capable. So you should be the leader for this particular task. And the second person, you can do this better than anyone, so you should take a leading role. So as a teacher, you can actually do that. It's allowed in the law. I think, do you think we have come to the end of the class? Okay, one last question. Sally, you can come to the microphone and speak to the microphone, please. You can come here as well. Yeah, we have an empty seat. Yeah.
Evening, Siaropia. I want to agree to your lecture, and I want to share my experience for the kid for the children. Even they are very young, but we give her with compassion and to relation between with students. They have confidence and they explain about their feeling, yes. Can I speak in your mouth?
Actually, your English is very good.
Thank you, Siarovia. I try my best. In Awasandra, 7 children at their...
That's Pantidharama.
Yes, I'm from Pantidharama, Siarikanda Sobha, Siarovia. 7 students at their holidays, they want to come to Awasandra as temporary nun, they ordain as temporary nun. Some students 5 days, some students 10 days. Yeah. So let this year, one student about 8 years old, she came and practiced, went to ordain to our center. At that time, I asked her questions. What is your intention to your ordain? She want to remove her default attachment here. Even she is only eight years old. So I said, Tami, what do you feel when you feel attachment? She said she want to cry. So her father is Professor Dr. Utiwadin, and her mother is Professor Dr. Nyamyae. So even she has only 8 years old, her attitude is very high. She said when she grew up, she went to stay at Switzerland because she likes peace. She doesn't want a war. That's why she went to stay when she grew up. When she and me between familiar, she's brave, and she want to speak, she want to learn from me. So I mean that the teacher center learning program or student center learning programs, whatever we use this program, the most important is the teacher. Because in the Buddha's teaching, Buddha said there are six qualities, six virtues: piyo, garubhavaniyo, vattaza, vachanakammo, gambiranza, katan, gadda, noza, thani, niyojako. So this is the Kalyana Metta qualify for the teacher. So that is why whatever learnings we use, the teacher must be skillful like this Buddha's teaching. So the small children, she said what she feels like this. Sometimes she this that is not realistic for her, but she wants to know if this is true or not. I explain according to the Buddha's teaching and my practice. So her mind is very high and very open in mind. So when I discuss with her, I record my phone, and after that I listen and I distribute to their parents. So it's very amazing her view for the world peace, to get world peace. So this is a very valuable time. If someone went to know the record of her opinion, so I want to share. So that's why this is very important for teacher, is whatever we use the learning of Siarovia. So ajang mishi vene kaleriu aluchin kadaha turu yajin deha anyai tabaya. Then tu mi baria teje tu demare ema aluka yu mapio bubure. ไอ้เราตู้เยตะมีเลโหดิโลอติญญานนี่ซาป้าเลใส่ทาดิพี่อ๋อโหเต็มเบ้เด้ด้วยอะมันเนาะเต็มนาต้องหมอบ่าวตู้หาเลดิซวยทุบไปနိုင်เด้ด้วยตะบี้โดอิมตันเจซุติมมาเลยเปียวบาเลยพะดาจองตะบี้โดรูก็บุทธะเตยาเนี่ยอันนี้กกกกกอะยังต้องกัลยาณมิตรกงยีพี่อ๋อหูอะยังจูซาพี่หลูอะติหาวเตยามเลยหลูอะหลูดิเสี่ยงฉิมมาเลย
Thank you, Sandy. Very good. That inspires. So I think So we have only this much time for today. We might as well bring this discussion to the end. And I'd like to thank everyone for coming today, for contributing, for making the class a more student-centered. It's still very much the teacher-centered, but I think it's getting the balance better and better. And I hope one day, you know, we will find the middle way, we walk the middle way between the student-centered and teacher-centered learning, benefiting from both approaches. Thank you.